Hello, hello. Welcome back to another edition of Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? I am your host, Elle Ariel, and we can be found at musicjobspodcast.com. That's musicjobs with an S, podcast.com. How's everyone doing? Are we hitting the ground running after summer vacation? I know it's hard to get motivated, but it is September, back to school, back to work, and I hope everyone is having some good, positive productivity going on this month. So just another little shout out for the podcast. We got mentioned in Access's 7 music related podcasts you should be listening to. Very happy about that. We were number 2. Whoop, whoop. So you can check the article out at accessaxs.com or actually on the Music Jobs podcast website. So last episode, I had the amazing pleasure of speaking with Lolita Ritmanis. She is an award-winning film composer, Emmy award-winning. She's won the BMI Champion Award for her work with the Alliance for Women Film Composers. So an amazing woman. I hope if you didn't get a chance to hear that episode, you would go back and listen to it. And, you know, we're all about talking to the movers and shakers and innovators from all aspects of the music industry, and we're almost coming up on a year. I can't believe it. I'm super stoked. So we're going to be rolling out a couple new features to go along with the podcast. So I'm really excited to be sharing them with you. Stay tuned. We'll have more information for you later on this month. So let's get on with the show. In this episode, I welcome the very, very talented professional drummer to the podcast, Anthony Citrinitti. He also goes by Aunt C. He has toured all over the world. He's been on the Warped Tour. He's played alongside Katy Perry and Joe Perry at the MTV Video Music Awards. He is also the director of the prestigious Collective School of Music in New York City. And on top of everything else, he's launching an app called Meathook. Not M-E-A-T, M-E-E-T-H-O-O-K, which is a great new app for musicians. He's going to tell us all about it. But first, here we go. You know I love to do this. We're going to play a track from one of Aunt C's bands called Embers Only, and this track is called Chosen One. Here we go. Don't look, now we're here to fix the mix. Back up from underground, and we take no shit. Yeah, we reset, no problem. How'd you get that music job?
Oh, thank you for having me. It's great to be here. Thanks.
Yeah, Friday night. We're hanging out Friday night. It's pretty cool.
Oh, yeah.
So tell me about childhood. Tell me about kind of those first memories you have of music. Were your parents playing a lot of music in the home? What do you kind of remember?
When I was a kid, my dad, you know, he still is, but, you know, at a very early age, I was exposed to music because my dad is a booking agent and manager. He's run his own agency since he was in his teens, and he's still running it, Tony C. Associates, out of upstate New York, Utica, New York. So at a very young age, he was taking me to shows because he had to pay the bands, and I was always that little kid standing backstage watching the drummer. And I just got hooked right away. And, you know, I was just always really into it. I always begged him to go to the shows, no matter who it was, whether I heard of him or not. It was like I just loved going and watching, you know, the musicians play. And I loved the music, but I loved the performance aspect of the music. I always was like sort of gravitated towards the musicians who really put on an amazing show. And I remember as early back as being like 8 or 9 years old, just, you know, not being able to wait till the next time I got to go with my dad to another one of these events where he had to go pay a band.
That is so go ahead.
I'm sorry, my uncle was in a band as well. He was the lead singer of a band when I was growing up. And so, you know, seeing your uncle up on stage at a young age, it just made a major impression on me. So that was another thing. I sort of like grew up just wanting to live my life in the way that I thought you needed to live it and sort of have a music career. And so, you know, everything I've done after that has been sort of with those young eyes and the musical brain, I guess I'll call it, that I developed in those early years of watching my dad and my uncle in the music business.
That's fantastic. And so you, I mean, it's in your blood. Like, you were truly immersed in it from day one, it sounds like, with that, you know, both your dad and your uncle doing it.
Yeah. And it was just, I was surrounded by it, and I really loved it. It really shaped who I am. You know, I'm 42 years old now, and we're talking from age 7 or 8, and I started taking drum lessons when I was 10, started in school, and my dad realized how serious I was maybe a couple years after that, and he found me a private teacher outside of school, so I was taking lessons with two different drum teachers growing up. He took me to every drum or music event that I asked to go to throughout all the years from, you know, grade school, junior high, high school. And mm-hmm. When I turned 18, I knew that I wanted to move to New York City. I grew up in upstate New York. It's about 250 miles outside of the city. And I found a music school in New York City called the Drummers Collective. It was really a drum school more than a music school. It sort of was a school that you go to prepare to have a career in music.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was 18, I got my parents to take me there for a tour and to apply. And I went there, and it was the weirdest thing. I walked into the place and I just felt so at home. I just knew from the second I walked through the door that was the place I had to go. It was just me. I just felt at home the second I walked in. And it's kind of crazy because that was me at 18, and I studied there. That was 1994, and I studied there at the time they had a 10-week program that I mm-hmm. took, and then I ended up staying for, my mom was like, okay, you can go do this for 3 months, 10 weeks, and then, you know, I'll keep your room together and you come back. Okay, yeah, sure. And after 3 months, I said, this is where I got to be. This is where the opportunities are. I was already, you know, making connections, networking, playing in bands, you know, auditioning for all sorts of stuff, and just studying and just trying to become the best musician I can be and immersing myself in music. And that led me to, after I finished my program and decided to stay in New York City and not go back home, I asked the director of the school because I had, it's kind of funny. The school had like a little pro shop where they sold drumsticks and, you know, the school shirt, and then you can get some books. And at that time there was like VHS tapes, like, you know, instructional videos and stuff. And so I was always going into that store, and I always wanted to buy, you know, I always needed sticks, and I always wanted to buy these videos and stuff. And so I went to the director one day and I said, hey, do you need anybody to work in the pro shop? Or is there anything that you need help with? Because I would really like to stick around here, but I just, you know, I'm not going to survive too much longer. I need to go find a job. So I wanted to start here. So he said, well, you know, can you come every morning and like make the deposit for me? And, you know, maybe you can help me out for a couple hours every day. I kind of need somebody to run to the bank and do some things. I said, yeah, sure. So I started at that school as a student at 18. About 6 months in, I started making bank runs for the director. That turned into me working in the pro shop. And then I worked in a few other places in the building, you know, doing different things. The people that were producing the VHS tapes, it was a company called DCI Music Video. And I ended up being a production assistant for them because they had an office on the third floor of that building. And then the collective was on the fourth. And, you know, it's pretty crazy, but 24 years later, I'm 42 and I'm still there. I went from student to working in this job and that job. And I did the scheduling. I did the every little job and position that you can have in that small school. I worked until about 2005. One of the bands I was in got super busy and started getting some notoriety, and we got offered a tour. The band was called The Smash Up, and I had been playing in the band for about a year or two. We recorded a record. We got a record deal from a company called Warcon Records, which was a mixture of Concrete Marketing and Warped Tour. So it was Kevin Lyman and Bob Chiappardi So Kevin Lyman was the guy who started Warp Tour, and Bob Chiappardi is the guy who started Concrete Marketing, where they're the ones that promoted the, you know, the Metallica, the big Metallica record that, you know, around that time, you know, Guns N' Roses, and they were really big in the industry. So those two guys put together a record company, and they signed the band that was in the Smash Up. So I left the collective. I said, I'm going to temporarily leave. Is it cool if I just go? I got to do a tour. I got offered a tour. This is kind of what I came to New York City to sort of try to do. And I'm, you know, I got this offer, so I'd love to do it. And they said, you know, listen, at the time I was an assistant director at the school because I had worked my way up from bringing the bank deposit. And so I took a temporary leave that turned into a permanent leave, at least for that time being, because I went on the road with the band, and that turned into getting another tour after that. So I spent most of my time late 2005, all of 2006, and a little bit of 2007 on tour most of the time with that band.
Let me stop you right there, because I want to actually back up just a little bit.
Absolutely. Sorry.
No, this is great. I just wanted to ask you about the decision to go to school when you were 18, because a lot of musicians, it's kind of that fork in the road, and a lot of musicians, especially if they feel like I got the chops and I got the band, I don't need to go continue my education. I don't need to go to school. What made you decide to go to the collective? I know you said you felt at home, but was it something that you felt was necessary to your career? I'm just always interested to hear in terms of education with musicians.
That is an amazing question, because I have a great answer for that. Of course, I wanted to get out of this small town that I grew up in, and I knew there was not many, you know, opportunities there for a musician, number one. Number two, I knew I wasn't as good as I could be, and I knew I had to get better, and I wanted to sort of be in a, you know, somewhere outside of my comfort zone so that I could really just delve in and like live that life. And the biggest reason is because, not even so much for the education, I knew that if I went to New York City, that I would have the opportunity to network and meet the people. And I knew that that was so much part of how you can make it in this business, is to, you know, it's a lot of people say it's all in who you know. So I heard that my whole childhood, and I said, at the very least, I will meet a lot of great people, and I know that someone along the way will see the way I play, and they will dig it, and they will either recommend me for something. Maybe I'll meet a drum teacher that I'm working with that gets called for a gig that he can't do. And that ended up happening a bunch of times. So yeah, it was about the networking opportunities, getting out of the small city and getting into the big city, and sort of not giving myself a way to be comfortable at all. I mean, I had to struggle to find a place that I could afford. I had to live, you know, sleep on floors and do all sorts of stuff that most people do not want to do. And you have to do that in order to, you know, you have to suffer for your craft. And I felt like, well, I have to pay my dues, and this is probably part of that. So let me just suck it up and do it. And it was fun, you know. I mean, looking back, it was rough. But I mean, you know, at the time, I didn't know any better. So I just wanted to live that life, and it allowed me to do that.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I think that's great to hear, too, because it wasn't just a question about, I need school for my success as a drummer. It's like, it sounds to me like you're saying, like, yes, I can work on my craft, but it can be a home base for me to then go mm-hmm. out in a major city, in a major entertainment capital, and network and utilize all the resources at the school, and then utilize everything around me in the city. So I think that's fantastic. That's such a great response to that, you know, because then it's not just like an either or question. It's a yes and question, you know, so I think that's great.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's important for me to mention that the collective is not your usual, you know, it's not like going to Berkeley or going to the New School and doing their music jazz program or whatever. I mean, the collective, and one of the things that sort of led me to the collective was that I heard so many great things. First of all, you always heard about all the magazines. When I was young, I'd get Modern Drummer every week, every month. I'd get Drum Magazine. I would go out to books and magazine stores. None of them exist anymore, but I would go out there and I would find any magazine I could about music or drums, and I would read it from cover to cover, and I would always hear about all these famous drummers and famous musicians that I love. There's always something where somebody says, yeah, I was at the Drummers Collective, or I was at the Collective. So I was sort of drawn to it because I was like, man, if all these guys are going there, if all these amazing musicians are there, or at least frequenting that place, like, I gotta go there. That's where I gotta be, you know? So the Collective, it, you know, they do these short programs. They have literally, you learn a style of music, and then they sort of plop you right into a rhythm section class with professionals. For example, like most music schools, as I know, and all the people that I know that go to these other music schools, most of them, you're grouped with students that are at the same level as you, and you end up performing and rehearsing and doing ensembles with those, your fellow students. The Collective actually will teach you, I'll use the example of Brazilian music, because it's not like you, most people go in there and they know their way around, you know, the Brazilian grooves and, like, you know, the whole history of the Brazilian, of the style of Brazilian music. That's just an easy one to use as an example, because what happens is, if the week that you study Brazilian at a school like the Collective, you learn about the history, you learn about the techniques that are part of the vocabulary of playing that style, and then the best part is when you, at the end of the week, after all this study leading up to this, they all lead up to this rhythm section, and then the rhythm section, they bring in top professionals, guys and girls, professionals, musicians who grew up with that style, who grew up in Brazil, who have been playing that music since they were little kids. So you literally are plopped in the middle of this, and you have to play your way out. And it's a really unique way to teach, and you really have to rise to the occasion. And I feel like every style, I learned 10 styles in 10 weeks. Of course, one of them was rock, and I went there with a lot of knowledge of rock. That's why I didn't use rock as an example. But it really is amazing that the education you get. So I didn't go there. It wasn't a quote-unquote college. So I didn't go there to learn the business end. I didn't go there to learn, you know, to take a minor and a major. I just went there to delve in, be the best as I could be on the drums, and learn as much vocabulary about all these different styles as I could, so that I could, in turn, take all that vocabulary and knowledge and turn that into my own style of playing, put my little stamp on it, take what I love from every different part of what I learned, and sort of mix it all together in a pot and turn it into what ended up being the style that I play. You know, the people that I play with, they know how I play, and it's not like this guy or that guy necessarily. It's just, you know, unique to me. And I think that's really important, to have your own voice. You can play a song exactly the way it's played on the record if you're playing a cover or something, but people should still hear your personality come out. And I think that type of education sort of got me that.
Mm-hmm. That's fantastic. So when you were not only doing session work, it sounds like you'd get grabbed for various gigs. You were in, was it several bands? Was it one band? What was that whole experience?
So the first serious band, I at the time, I would get the Village Voice. It would come out every Wednesday. I found out actually where I could get it Tuesday night, because there were certain places where they would drop a huge, I don't know if you ever heard of the Village Voice, but they actually they just sold or closed their doors or whatever. They've just ceased the magazine, which I just read the article last week. But when I moved to New York City in 94, that was where you went. That was the classified ads, and that was like the Bible. So there was no Craigslist. There was no www. Nothing. It was like Village Voice and good luck. I would go get the Village Voice on Tuesday night because I knew the place that they dropped it, right near Tower Records on Broadway. That's gone too, unfortunately. It's really sad to walk around New York and see 48th Street is completely gone. That was where all the music stores were. There's not one music store there anymore.
Wow.
And, you know, it's really changed. But, you know, things have to change. Anyways, I'd get the Village Voice on Tuesday night. I'd go home. I'd circle every possible ad. If a band was looking for a drummer and they had anything in the ad that sparked my interest, like they had, a lot of bands would say, we're influenced by this band or that band. Most of the time, if I saw one band that I dug that they said were an influence, I circled the ad and I'd call them the next day.
Wow.
I would go on auditions whether I wanted the gig or not, or whether I knew I wanted it or not, because I felt like if I don't get it, I'm going to meet new people. They're going to have the opportunity to see me play and hear me play. I'm going to get the same opportunity and I'm going to learn this way. I really had some great mentors through the collective, through the school. I got some great mentors that just, you know, sort of naturally became my mentors. It wasn't like an official thing. It was just like I became friends with them, and that I took their advice, and that's a lot what a lot of them did and said. So I did that. I went on a ton of auditions. Some bands I played at one, you know, I played one gig with. Some bands I did recordings with. So it was just kind of like just doing whatever I could to be out there, because it's like I'm in New York City. I'm paying a lot of money to live here. I'm going to make the most of it. I'm going to see what I can turn this into. So I did that for years. The first established band that I got into was a band called the Bush Pilots. And coincidentally, I answered an ad that was on the bulletin board at the collective, at the music school I was going to, that I was working at that time. So I saw the ad. They were looking for a drummer. I showed up. I auditioned, they hired me. They said, you're great, we want you in the band. I started playing with them. This is actually an insanely crazy story, and I'll give you the quick version. What happened was, we played about 6 months of shows. We had so many people coming out to the shows. The band had already had some popularity in the city. It was new to me to play gigs where there were like hundreds of people at every gig. I actually walked out of each gig with money. I was like, when does an original band that's not signed get paid at the end of the night?
Right,
like, this was
right.
New.
Totally.
It was so new, but they had a lot of fans. It was crazy. Two of the guys were from Denmark, and they came up with some scheme where, hey, we know of all the, there's these agencies that place people who are from foreign countries who want to come to New York City, and they want to be nannies, and they call them au pairs.
Yeah,
and they
yeah.
were... Yeah, so they had these agencies. They were, the bass player and the guitar player were keyed in with these agencies. So they knew the people at the agencies. And what they were doing is they were networking with them. And so when they had when we had a show, we would make sure the agency knew about it, because what would happen was we ended up getting a mailing list of all the places that these au pairs were stationed, let's say, or where, you know, the houses that they were working in. And we would send our little, you know, in the mail, the little cards you make up. Back in the day, everybody made them up, and, you know, you put the stamp, the postcard stamp on it. And we would send them to every agency and every address that we could find that was associated with one of these au pairs that was out of the country. And we made sure they knew that there were guys from Denmark in the band, and, you know, most of these au pairs were coming from Europe, so they didn't really know where to go, what to do. They wanted to go out and have a good time when they had their Friday night free or their Saturday night free, so it was amazing. They figured out that they can do this, and instantly we had 100 beautiful European girls in all of our shows.
Wow, and, that's a great marketing strategy.
It really is. I don't know if it would work nowadays, but I'll tell you, they figured it out. I can't take any credit for it, but it was pretty amazing. And they were great guys. We played a lot of great shows, lots of people. And here's the crazy part of the story. We were having meetings with EMI at the time and Virgin Records, and we felt like, you know, back then it was like, oh, man, I think we're going to get a record deal, you know. And back then, if you think you're going to get a record deal, maybe I was naive, but it was me and all my friends. We all had the same sort of feeling. It's like when you hear you might be getting signed, it was like, this is it. We're going to be big, you know.
Right,
that's at least
right.
what you thought about. That's not like that nowadays, but back then, that was the vibe. So what did I do? Naive Anthony went to work. At the time, I had taking a part-time job. You know, I was still working at the Collective part-time, and then I took a part-time job in a bakery. So I walked into the bakery the next day after this meeting with EMI because we felt like we were being signed. And I said, hey, I'm giving my notice. You know, I'm going to be famous. We're going to be rock stars. We're going to go on tours. We're putting a record together. EMI is signing us. This is going to be great. So 1 week after that, because of these agencies and all the friends that we've made that came to New York from all these other countries to be nannies, there was always some new people coming into town. And these guys were, like I said, they were keyed in with that. And so they had offered to take a group of au pairs to the Empire State Building. This is in February of 1997. My guitar player and my bass player and my singer. I went to the bakery that morning. It was a Sunday morning to work at the bakery. Those three guys went up on the Empire State Building with a bunch of European au pairs. And that was the day that crazy Palestinian gentleman went up.
Yeah, I remember.
My guitar player was shot and killed. My singer was shot and lived, actually. And my bass player wasn't hurt at all. So my guitar player was killed on the observation deck, and my singer was rushed to the hospital. I then proceeded to spend the next 6 months by his side in the hospital. Well, not the next 6 months, the next 2 months by his side in the hospital. He was in a coma for like 2 or 3 weeks. It was like the most horrible, crazy time in my life. Obviously, everything, the band, all of a sudden, I had no band, no job, and I was kind of like back to square one, I felt. And I was so worried for my friend who was like, you know, fighting for his life. So crazy story, but yeah. There is a positive spin. The positive spin is he survived. My lead singer survived. His name is Matthew Gross. He survived. He went through a lot of rehabilitation. And how's about 18 years later, like I think it was about 2 years ago, him and I met up after losing touch for a little while. He asked me if I wanted a jam. I said, absolutely. I met him at the Collective. I rented a room for us. We went into the room. The guy starts playing Knocking on Heaven's Door. I got the chills. We played, him and I played that song together. And, you know, we played it. We jammed a couple other songs, a couple of the songs we played way back when. And he said, you know, I would love to play another gig. I said, are you serious? If you want to play a gig, I am going to make it my mission to make this happen, because I can't believe we are in the room together playing music after all that you've been through. It's quite amazing. So I booked him a gig, me and him, and we hired a bass player because, you know, we didn't have an official band together. So we threw a band together, and I got to play on stage with him one more time, and it was really amazing. And the kid he's unbelievable. The bullet went through his brain.
Wow.
And he somehow not only survived, but he can walk, he can talk, he can do anything that everyone else can do. And he can play the guitar. He writes music all the time. He can still sing. You know, I think he had to relearn how to do everything, but he's back. You know, in my opinion, he's 100%. I don't know what, you know, his close family and friends would say, but man, I can't tell the difference. The guy's amazing.
Wow, that's an amazing story. Tell me more about this tour that you were going to go on when you actually left the Collective for good and you were like, this is it, I'm going on tour, and you went on a big tour. What was that experience like?
That was amazing. I had never been on an official tour. We went to England first. We had a record company in England that decided to sign us and put our record out. We put a record out in England called Untreatable. It was on Mighty Atom Records, and they brought us out there at the end of 2005 for a tour. There's a famous band in England called Three Colors Red, and they were very popular in the late 90s. And actually, the funny story with them is that they were number one on the charts, and then they got beat out for the number one spot by Chef from that cartoon. I can't think of the name of it. South Park, and his song "Chocolate Salted Balls." I don't know if you remember that.
Yes,
but they got knocked out number one spot by that, and sort of they broke up soon after that. I don't think that was the reason, but they broke up. Anyways, they had a reunion tour. They were on Mighty Atom Records. Mighty Atom said, hey, we want the Smash Up to go on tour with you guys. So we opened up for them. It was my first time in England, and it was probably one of the best tours. It was the first tour, and it was one of the best tours up till this day that I've ever been on. It was a lot of fun. It was amazing being in a foreign country and playing for sold out shows every night. They had a large fan base, so we got the ability to play in front of lots of people who had no idea who we were. And then when we were done, they loved it. They bought records, they bought shirts, and we hung out with them, and it was a lot of fun.
Nice.
So that was the first thing.
Uh-huh.
Thank you. After that, we went to, because we were on the Warcon label, Kevin Lyman from Warped Tour asked us to do what they, at the time, they called it the Winter Warped Tour. It was called Taste of Chaos Tour. Mm-hmm. And that was an amazing call that I got to be able to, to get invited to go on that tour, because the headliner was the Deftones. And at the time, the Deftones were my favorite band.
Yeah.
So I went on tour with the Smash Up, opening up for the Deftones, and there were a bunch of other great bands on that tour. We were one of the baby bands that were kind of unknown at the time, but we still got the ability to do it because of our record label. It was amazing. While we were on that tour, Warped Tour was coming up. They said, hey, you guys are doing great on this tour. Do you want to do Warped Tour? So we ended up doing Warped Tour right after that. We got like a week off after that tour, and then we did 52 shows in 62 days on Warped Tour, the whole summer of 06. That was quite amazing. We shared a bus. It was a bus that slept 20 people, and there were 22 people on the bus.
Oh, God.
And, so more paying dues, it wasn't, people were like, wow, that's amazing. You're on tour. It must be awesome. You must be all cushy. And yeah, now, we're sharing. Some of us were sleeping standing up because there was nowhere else to sleep. But we got through it. It was a lot of fun. And amazingly, while we were on the Warped Tour, my guitar player got a phone call from Dave Mustaine, the lead singer of Megadeth. And, of course, he didn't believe it. He said, oh, this is, who's pranking me? What is this? Turned out Bob Chiappardi, the guy who ran Concrete Marketing, who was part of our label, is friends with Dave Mustaine. And told Dave about us, gave Dave our record. Dave loved it, and he offered us to go on his package tour, which was kind of like his version of Ozfest. It was called Gigantour. I think they did like three or four of those tours, and we were on the second one. So we opened up for Lamb of God and Megadeth, and we did that tour right after. So it was like three large arena tours, one after the next, and it was like, I had died and gone to heaven, basically. It was everything. It was everything that I had ever dreamed of. And the only crappy part was I got done from the tour and I realized that I was broke and I had no money. And I, it's like everybody, you meet people on the road and they don't really know how hard it is. And they're thinking, oh, you were just on stage in front of thousands of people, so you must be rolling in the cash. Mm-hmm. And, it's a sad thing when they actually find out that, no, it's not like that, Yeah, you bought our record, but that money went directly to the record company because we haven't recouped yet. And, yeah, you bought our shirt that goes to buy for gas so that our bus can get us to the next stop.
Yeah.
And we're lucky to just, we got on our rider was peanut butter, jelly, and Wonder Bread. And every night I had two peanut butter and jelly. That's it.
Yeah.
And I was lucky if I got a couple beers as well and maybe a couple water. We just, whatever. It was part of the whole experience. I wouldn't change anything. If I had to do it over again, it was amazing. And unfortunately, right after Gigantour, my singer wanted to get married and have a baby with his wife. And my bass player followed suit. And I was left with just me and my guitar player. And we sort of took a long break and then tried to put the band back together a little while later. It didn't really amount to much. We put out a great record with a new singer that I'm very proud of. It's the Smash Up. It's called, our first record was called Being and Becoming. That was our first U.S. release. And I got to go to Tower Records and buy it before all the record stores closed down. I feel very lucky to have been able to go into a store, see my CD on the shelf, and buy it. Because all the people that I meet, you know, all the students at the school that I meet that are on their way up now, they will never know what that feels like, you know.
Right, totally.
And yeah, so the first one we put out was Being and Becoming. The second one we put out was The Sea and the Serpents Beneath. That I'm probably most proud of that record that I did with the Smash Up, even though it wasn't that well received because it was a new singer and we already had our fan base and they all liked the original version of the band. So it didn't last very long, but that was the end of my touring days with the Smash Up anyways. And
yeah.
that was the end of 2006, beginning of 2007.
Okay. So, I mean, and that's such a great story and also a really good reality check, because I think you're absolutely right. And I've heard it from other musicians as well, from all different genres, rap artists, et cetera. Like they, you think you get signed to a label, you go on tour, like that's it. Happy ending. End of story. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's amazing. But the reality is you will probably come home broke. You know, you're not really making, unless you're like Metallica or something, you're just not going to be making the kind of money that people hear about, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, it's taken me many years to get to this point. And I believe, I had made the decision not too long ago that I am never going to play music with the idea of making money. Now, that doesn't mean that if I get hired for a gig that I'm not going to take the money when they want to pay me at the end of the night. What I'm saying is I do not make musical decisions mm-hmm. about my music and my music career. I do not make them based on money, because mm-hmm. I realize the second you start doing that, the music is not as good.
Yeah.
I've been at plenty of sub gigs because I needed the money to pay my rent. And, you know, I had to play music that I did not like, but I could play it. So I couldn't say no. I needed the money. But, you know, it's not satisfying at all. You feel like you're whoring yourself out. It's so dissatisfying. And then you feel sometimes you're embarrassed to play with certain people, you know, just because they might have some money behind them because they have a relative that, you know, well off or whatever. Some people find ways of sort of financing their career, and they get managers or people that just want to put a great band together behind them. So I've been in many of those projects because I had to be, and I was lucky to have them because I needed the money. But, you know, too many of those decisions, you know, I passed up probably some great opportunities along the way because I had to do some gig that paid me $500 that was completely not what I was into and not what I wanted to do. But, you know, at the end of the day, I felt like, well, it's music. At least I'm out there, I'm being active, I'm playing, and I'm paying my bills, so I got to do it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's not a good idea to make decisions with your music career and your artistic integrity. When you start bringing money into it, I believe that it's you're watering it down right off the bat. So if you do everything from your heart and soul and money comes, terrific. I feel that it's part of the musician's job, especially nowadays, to find a way to sustain their lifestyle, whatever it is. Or if they can't sustain it, then you need to make some decisions. Maybe the lifestyle you're living is not the appropriate one if you really want to be a working musician, because you have to find a way to sustain that. So whatever, get a side job that pays you enough to where you don't have to focus on music for money, and then you use all your extra time and you put it into music. Honestly, it's a great segue. I'm not trying to rush into the segue, but it's a great segue into my app.
I was just going to ask about your app. So I think that's brilliant. And that's such great, innovative, kind of out of the box thinking. It's how you are a music entrepreneur. So yeah, please tell us about that.
The app is called Meet Hook, and that's M-E-E-T. It's kind of like you meet a musician or a music professional and you hook into their skills, and you get, you know, you can get a lesson from them. Perhaps you can have a discussion with them. The way it works is you sign up for Meet Hook. You look through a number of profiles of professional musicians. Right now we have a little over 300 professional musicians. I would say 80% of them are professional drummers, and that's because I'm in the drum industry and I have access to them. The whole idea is giving you and anyone else who wants access to them the ability to do that. And what it is you find a profile of a musician you're interested in and you like their profile. It's just like Instagram. You just fill in the heart on their profile. And then what happens is when they are available, you get a notification. The app notifies you. So for a guy, I'll use Kenny Aronoff as an example. He's a professional drummer who plays with, he made his name playing with John Cougar Mellencamp. And from then he's played with just about everybody. His list, his discography is longer than the Bible. You can just keep reading, and there's every name is more recognizable than the next. He's played with everybody. Mm-hmm. He's had an amazing 30 to 40 year career. He just wrote a book recently. He's one of the hosts on our app. I'll just use him as an example. There are plenty of drummers out there, professional musicians, but there might be someone out there that wants to hire him to do a recording. They have no other way to access that, him. They mm-hmm. can now access him through a meet hook. The idea is that you, once that musician is available that you want to talk to, and it's not just musicians, it's music professionals. So it could be your favorite drummer, it could be a guitar player, anyone who plays any instrument, or it could be a producer, a songwriter, it could be a music attorney, a publicist. Honestly, you could have a profile up there. You do a music podcast. I'm sure there's other expertise you have in music. The idea is that if somebody wants to know something, you know, about what that person does or what they've done or what they have knowledge in, it's kind of like that person has walked the path before you, and maybe now you can sort of hook into what they do and learn from them. Maybe you can just network with them. So the app allows you to have a one-on-one video call with that person when they become available.
That's great. Is it by region? Like, do they do it like with by geographic region, or how do they do it?
No, it's a video call through the app. So really, when you sign up for the app, it asks, just click on the music category, and mm-hmm. then there's a whole drop-down menu of every skill that someone could have in music. And once you click on that skill, so let's say you just want to play the flute, and you don't even know where to start. So you go on the app, you find the flute skill, and then you see every post that is listed on the app that has flute as one of their skills. At mm-hmm. that point, you can go on their profile, either see when they're available, or if they're not available, favorite their profile, and when they do become available, you get notified. We did it like that because I knew that most musicians are extremely busy, and you don't necessarily know if you're going to have an hour available next Tuesday. So we have the ability for the host to not only put in their future schedule if they know it, so that people can book them when they're available, or they're not available, and when they have a free moment, they can turn the app on and just make themselves available instantly. And as soon as they click, it's called Meet Hook Now. They click Meet Hook Now, and mm-hmm. they say how long they're available, and they say turn on. And then as soon as they click that button, everyone who's been on the app, who has favorited their profile, gets a notification that they are now available. And instantaneously, you can get that notification, go on the app and book them. And within 2 minutes, you could be staring at them, be face-to-face with them through the app, just like a Skype or a FaceTime. And you can have that conversation with them. Some people offer lessons. Some people just offer discussions. And some people want to just give you advice. So they have the option of saying what they're available for, how much they need to get paid, and they choose a price per hour. And then it depends on how long you want to book them for. Some people are available for only hours. Some people, most of them actually, because it's so new, what I recommend is that if you have skills in music, you can go on the app, you can set up your profile. And what I suggest is you put 10-minute set, you make yourself available for 10-minute sessions, because even if you need $200 an hour, it's easier for someone to bite off of just a small chunk of that because they're only paying for 10 minutes. And that 10 minutes is the perfect amount of time for them to see how the app works because it's new. People are always like, you know, I don't know how this is going to be. So it lets them get their feet wet, gets them a little bit of face time with whoever this person is, and they don't have to pay an arm and a leg to do it. And I think it's the perfect sort of sample for them to see how it works. So if they are digging it, then of course they can change their availability for tomorrow or the next day, or decide next month they're going to be available for 4 hours a day. That's happened already with a number of people. One of the people that I think one of the most famous drummers we have on the app right now is Jonathan Moffett. He played drums behind Michael Jackson for 30 years.
Wow.
He makes himself available all the time, and he's probably the most successful meat hook host that we have at this point, as far as using, being an early user of the platform and really understanding how it works, promoting himself on the app, and getting people to book him, and he's done a lot of successful sessions. Now, the app allows both the user and the host, the person who books the session and the person that's available for the session. As soon as the session is done, each of them get to rate the person that they spoke to and the session itself. So that gives the next person in line the ability to see the value that they might get. Or if the host is looking at who booked them, they can actually see the rating of the user, so they can see, you know, what kind of person is this that I'm about to be talking to.
So it's like Uber. It's like Uber for music.
That's a really good way to explain it. I try not to use apps to explain my app because I've been told that it's probably not the best thing to do. But yes, that's originally what I was telling people. It's kind of like FaceTime meets Uber, you know. And I wanted to mention or sort of, you know, connect a couple things that I said earlier, because it really was how this idea developed for me. If you go back to what I said about when I was on tour and I was broke and I was meeting people and they had this sense that I was like this rock star with all this money in the bank. Mm-hmm. It's honestly, that is a big part of where this idea developed, because I work at the music school with all these professional musicians. They come in and they do, you know, master classes or clinics. And these guys and girls that come in, and professional musicians that come in and do these things, if you're in the position I'm in, you see how hard these people are struggling and how much they're hustling, because yeah, they don't know when their next gig is coming, and they're trying to make the money when they can make it. Now, that doesn't mean that they're bringing a lot of value to the table, and they're, you know, and it's worth it for them to do this, and I believe it's very satisfying. But most people do not realize that these people, they're playing every night in front of thousands of people, but they're not really making ends meet, and there needs to be other ways. And it wasn't easy to make money with your music back in the day, but it's absolutely impossible at this point. I mean, you know, with the streaming and all these other services, I don't have any problem with them. I know that technology is making a lot of things easier and it's making other things harder, but I believe that Meat Hook is one of the new technologies that I've developed, and I believe that it's actually, once people realize, because we're very new, we're only about 7 months in the game. I've been developing it for almost 3 years, but we've been live for about 7 months. I think that it is a really great opportunity for these professional musicians who have name recognition, and not just them, but I'm just highlighting them because they have name recognition. Most of them have Instagram and Facebook accounts where their fans have limited access to them, and their fans can keep up to date with what they're up to. But this app allows them to monetize their fans one by one and really give their fans an experience, you know? Mm-hmm. It's kind of like a meet and greet at a concert, except it's whenever they have time. And it's right over the phone, so, you know, you don't have to worry about being at the same place. You know, think about the guy who has a really great gig, but he broke his leg, so he's home because he had to find a sub. That guy can sit on his couch and make some money by talking to his fans, and his fans can get an amazing experience because they love what the person does, you know, when they're up on stage, or they want to, you know, find out a little more details. Hey, how did you do this? How did you do that? So it's a great way for people to connect. It's not about lessons as much as it's about just connecting live and one-on-one and having that personal conversation, that personal connection with someone who inspires you. And it doesn't have to be someone with name recognition. It can literally be someone who's just really great at piano, and you watched a couple of their YouTube videos and you're like, man, I got to find out how they do that, or what how did they write that song? Or what did, you know, whatever is in your mind, you know, you can, I don't know. I watch tons of videos, and I know every time I watch a video, I have questions when I'm done. I don't care if I'm watching an interview or watching a live concert. When that thing is done, I'm like, I always have at least 5 or 6 questions. Now, maybe I just have a thirst for knowledge and I'm very inquisitive about stuff. But I feel there's a lot of people out there like that. And all of us musicians, we steal from other people and make it our own. And, you know, we try to grow every day and be a better player. And this, I think, is a really great way to connect with someone that you would never otherwise have access to. Learn from them, talk with them, network with them. You never know what it could turn into.
Thank you so much. And we're running out of time, so I want people to find out. Can you again give me the name of the app? Also, how people can follow you, find the collective, all that good stuff.
Absolutely. And thank you for having me. So my name is Anthony Citrinitti. I go by Ant C. To many people, that's how I'm known. The collective could be found on the web at thecollective.edu. The app can be found on the web at meethook.com. That's meethook.com. We're on Instagram at MeetHookApp. We're also on Facebook and Twitter and all those other ones. It really was great talking to you. I really hope that people go, you can go to the App Store and download the app. If you have an Android phone, you can go on Google Play and download the app. Please check it out.
Well, I'm excited to check it out myself.
Awesome. I think you would do great on there as well. You know, there's a lot of people that are interested in starting podcasts and they really don't know where to start. So maybe you can give advice to some people on that.
Cool. All right. Thank you so much, Anthony. I so appreciate having you on.
Oh, well, thank you so much, too. I hope I didn't talk too much.
Oh, Anthony, we love it that you talk, because that's what this podcast is all about, talking to the movers and shakers and innovators in the music industry. So thank you again to Anthony for sharing all that really, really good stuff. So this MeetHook app is a pretty big deal if you didn't figure that out. And I wanted to give a shout out for MeetHook for people in Los Angeles. They are actually going to be in LA next week, September 19th. They are going to be hosting Jane's Addiction, Stephen Perkins, the famous drummer from Jane's Addiction. They're going to have a free performance workshop clinic at the Guitar Center in Pasadena. So get on Facebook and you can look it up, or Instagram at MeetHook app, or the website meethook.com. Really, really good stuff. So I would get that app downloaded ASAP. Okay, so this ends another week of Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? We're also on all the social media platforms at Music Jobs Podcast. And if you are streaming us, I keep forgetting to ask, if you are streaming us on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Android, any of those streaming platforms, please give us some stars, give us some love, give us some feedback so we can get our numbers up and more people can find out about this podcast. We can help more and more people that are looking for a career in music and just don't know where to start, where to begin, how to do it, because we are all about helping people and connecting people and just hearing these amazing, inspiring stories and advice and experiences from all these amazingly talented individuals in the music industry like Aunt C. Okay, so everyone, take good care. Keep on hustling. Remember, we're going to keep on hustling. Pursue that dream and don't you give up.